Hey, music lovers. The Can a Mom Show podcast, in collaboration with Lambkin Guitars, is giving away a custom-built, one-of-a-kind electric guitar built by Josh Lambkin. The solid one-piece hemp wood body includes a built-in glass bowl piece. Yeah, you heard me right. You can take a hit and then play a lick. Now's your chance to help the Can a Mom Show crush cannabis stigma with your entry. Register for the hemp guitar giveaway online at lambkinguitars.com. That's L-A-M-K-I-N guitars.com. The drawing will be part of a 420 celebration at the Goods Dispensary in Somerville, Massachusetts, where the guitar is on display for the month of April. But don't worry, you don't have to live in Mass or be present to win. Visit lambkinguitars.com to scope out the hemp guitar giveaway details and entry form. You'll even find a video of what could be your guitar in action. L-A-M-K-I-N guitars.com. If you're a cannabis business owner looking to expand into new markets and need guidance and support you can trust, consider Collateral Base, a group that has done it before in multiple merit-based and limited market states. Collateral Base was founded by an experienced cannabis attorney with highly educated consultants with master's degrees and years of experience in the cannabis industry. The Collateral Base team is confident they know cannabis licensing better than any of their peers. And I encourage you to see for yourself. It just takes one phone call. If you're ready to expand your cannabis business into new limited markets, contact Collateral Base today at 309-306-1095. That's 309-306-1095. Or visit collateralbase.com.
Everything is personal right here. Everything is personal right here. Everything is personal right here. Len and John rolling it up, listening as they change the industry.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to another episode of Everything is Personal. I have a very special guest today, a friend, a legend in our industry, Mr. Seth Ektan.
Wow, what do you possibly even say to that? Good night. Thank you, Cleveland.
Just all take right. It, man. Yeah. Take the flowers, man. Take the flowers.
Thank you, man. That means a lot coming from you, and a legend in my own mind completely. But thank you. It's very nice of you to say that. Thank you.
No, I appreciate you being here. I dug into a lot of your content, and I was, you know, reading some interviews and stuff, and I'm a fan of what you do on LinkedIn, and we'll get into all that stuff. But I found it interesting, like, your childhood is interesting to me. So first, I want people to really understand, because there, you know, we just don't show up and end up like this. There is history behind this. So let's tell people sort of where you grew up first, and we'll talk about sort of your upbringing, your family.
So the legend is my dad, right? I'm just a Nepo baby. My dad grew up in an orphanage. He was incarcerated more than once, ran numbers for the Philly mob, and he could play sports, and he used sports as a way to get out of the jungle. And he could sell ice cubes to an Eskimo in a snowstorm at night. And that skill was transmuted to me. So in 67 or 68, he became the number one salesman in the United States for Sandoz Pharmaceuticals. It's now Novartis. And he went on to become the salesperson of one of the earliest consumable companies servicing biotech researchers. Being a street guy, he just wanted to sell more product, and he figured out a way to trade product for equity in companies like Genentech and a company called Isis, and a few of the seminal companies in the industry. and became a VC as a result of that. So that was kind of the landscape that I grew up in.
Well, you were born in Philly, right?
I was born in Philadelphia. I lived in South Jersey until I was sixth grade. And my father sold the company that he was part of to DuPont. And we ended up moving to Boston because the HQ was in Boston. And after a year, we moved to Southern California. So I did seventh grade in Boston and eighth grade in Southern California. And the shift from Boston to Philadelphia to Boston was shocking. I grew up in a town. I'm Jewish. Hopefully no one's offended by that. I grew up in a town where everybody was Jewish. Like literally. Like I remember sitting around my grade school and I was in a room of 26 kids and there was 20 Jewish kids. There was an African-American kid. There was three Asian kids. Like that was, and a Latino person. That was it. And I went to Boston and I experienced what is now called anti-Semitism on a real first level after school, you know, jailhouse rock. You're going to get the crap kicked out of you basis. And then I went to California, which is like, oh my God, what is like, what is this? So I had an interesting experience there, which shaped me.
You know, we have a really interesting kind of connection. So I'm a Philly guy too. I was born in Lithuania and I'm Jewish and my family immigrated here to Philly for that whole, you know, religious persecution. And when I moved to Philly, we lived in a really shitty neighborhood in Northeast Philly, but like on a really, you know, a tough street. And Philly, you know, as you know, is a tough town, but I never got Jewish. For what I got was Russian. You're Russian. Right. This I'm not even Russian, but you know, the geography is challenging for people in the U.S. So, you know, you're part of Soviet, so you got to be Russian, but the whole trajectory of growing up in Philly and, you know, dealing with that, I actually did some work in Boston. I worked for MIT and Harvard at that time. And I thought, man, I'm like, Philly, Boston, it's kind of the same thing. It's not completely different. And a move into LA was also completely different. But I went to public school, so I didn't have, like, I wasn't living in a Jewish neighborhood and all that stuff. It was a melting pot. And I went to college at Temple, North Philly. So that was a whole interesting kind of thing too. But were your parents, you talk about your dad, were your parents together with the...
My parents were together all the way to the end. Yep.
Got it.
All the way to the end, thick and thin.
Do you have siblings?
I have a sister who's 4 years younger than me, who I actually still live with. And who's my partner in just about everything. If it wasn't for my family, I'd have nothing, man. So timestamp it and we can put it in there. Thank you to my sister for standing by me and having my back. I mean that. I love her.
I love that. So going back to, you know, your dad's story is amazing. It's such an inspirational story. And I can see how it can motivate you. But as a kid, like, what were your interests? Like, what were you into? Were you into sports? Were you into art? Like, because I had so many friends, and I think you said this in an interview somewhere, but I had so many friends before that were just like, pick up the guitar. Like, oh, shit, I'm doing this the rest of my life. I know what I'm going to do. Or like a paintbrush, I'm going to paint for the rest of my life or something like that. I didn't have that. I was always trying to figure out even though I loved music and that was my thing, I never really had like, this is mine. I want to do this, then I want to do this, then I want to do that. What kind of kid were you?
Well, it's interesting. You know what? It kind of changed for me as I moved. When I was younger, I was fascinated by dinosaurs and I thought I was going to be a paleontologist or a neurosurgeon. That year in Boston was hard. You know, it was hard. You grow up till you're in sixth grade. You've got friends. You know everybody. you put into a place for 9 months where everybody hates you and you're just trying to figure out which end is up. And then you go to the land of milk and honey in California. It kind of changed. What I developed in that process probably was two things. One was a real thick skin, and I do have a quick wit, and some people do think I'm funny. I try not to be professionally funny, but I always knew I could get somebody to laugh. And that was just a disarming thing, even if it's in a totally self-deprecating manner. And that was always like my default way in. When I came to California, I realized that getting people to make you laugh was really just selling. All you're doing is selling yourself, and your objection de-escalating as a result of that. I'm already on your page because I got you. Like, I got you. And it changed. I started a stall at a swap meet when I was 13 years old after working for a guy for 2 summers. I was like, I could do this. And I did. And my dad was so overwhelming in terms of his presence and the level of respect. Like, life, it was kind of like being in the mob. Like, life was business and business was life. There was no separation. So there was always be 7 guys in suits in the living room doing stuff. And I was like, I want to do this stuff. Like, I don't know what it is, but this is what I want to do. So I think by the time I was 14, 15 years old, I just kind of knew that doing transactions was what I wanted to do. I did act. I thought about doing stand-up comedy. One of my best friends from high school is a famous actor. His name is Matthew Lillard. Friends with him till this day. Just dropped a big, 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 go see Five Nights at Freddy. If you haven't seen it, hook up my boy, the star of Scream. He was in my wedding. So I thought about doing that, but I kind of honestly thought that I was going to fail, and that if I went to school and learned a trade, I would always have that to fall back on. And that's kind of how I got to where I was.
So you went to school for what?
I went to college because that's what you were supposed to do. I studied history and public affairs while I was there. To be totally honest, my dad had a very well-known patent attorney that he had made a ton of money for in a litigation settlement, who gave me a job every summer, who was going to pay for me to go to law school. So every summer I was in college, I interned at a law firm. And I thought I was going to go to law school and be an attorney. And something happened. 91, 92, you're old enough to remember this. There was a war and there was a recession. You couldn't get a job delivering pizzas. And I was like, I remember I was at this law firm, like, 7-8 o'clock at night, and one of the girls who I knew, who was like an associate, was literally like drinking whiskey in the office. And I was like, this looks like hell. Like, I'm not cut out for this. I gotta go figure out how to invest in companies. And I drove across the country and I came back to California. My dad threw me out of his house, literally threw me out of his house. And I started showing up at this venture fund every day. Literally every day. The woman who was the administrative assistant for the guy who ran this gigantic fund loved me, and I would just go and talk to her, and then I would just sit in the office and I wouldn't leave. Like, I stalked these people, and then they were finally like, okay, well, you can sit there. And then they were finally like, okay, well, you can do this. And then after, like, I don't know, 3-4 months, one of the guys who was an associate was like, all right, well, here's the deal. Like, we have 2 interns that are MBAs for the summer, but if you like make copies, we'll pay you. I was like, sure. And I spent 4 years there. So that's how I kind of got on, you know.
But you, correct me if I'm wrong, but you also worked in banking, correct?
So yeah. So my dream was I wanted to go to Wall Street and be a banker. That's what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. So I went back to UC Irvine. I paid my own way to go to UC Irvine, I'll add. and got some work study, got some scholarship, worked three jobs while I was there, and was convinced that I was going to go back to Wall Street to get a job because I didn't have an MBA and I didn't have a business degree. Other than being my dad's kid, nobody really wanted to talk to me. And I had no experience, right? I did 4 years in a venture fund. Great. Go back and get your MBA. And I did. And to be honest, I was dating a girl that I thought I was going to marry. And I ended up getting a job working for a Union Bank inside of a fund in the bank that invested money into LBOs. And I said, okay, I'm just going to go do this. And I took the job. The girl broke up with me 90 days later. And then I was in this bank for 8 years.
Wow.
And it was, I will tell you that working in that group at Union Bank and working for Union Bank, probably other than the 2 or 3 years, or the 2 years that I spent at Ease, is the most that I've learned anywhere. Like the first 2, 3 years in that position was just awesome.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how like traditional banking influenced sort of your investment strategy going forward.
It shaped it. I'm really bad as an investor. I'm really bad as an equity investor. I'm really good at hard money and hard asset. That's where my comfort is. I've invested historically 90% of my earnings in Berkshire and Berkshire A. Like I'm just not, and munis, right? Like I'm not, if I'm going to try and make capital appreciation, it's by doing something. My time there didn't shape my investment strategy as much as it I became a ninja there. I became a Jedi master working there.
Yeah, it gave you the basis and risk assessment, and maybe there is some risk aversion there based on what you just said. But you, it seems to me you have this entrepreneurial mindset, and I could be off on that, but it just sort of what it feels, and based on me diving into your content and all that stuff, having a traditional, like I work for PW and PwC, and having this corporate, you know, I was a long hair earring guy, tattoos kind of thing, and working in that environment, I felt I was boxed in, and I always had this entrepreneurial kind of drive to do something else. It did give me a basis on that, but there's something else from there. So taking some of that from traditional banking, am I correct to assume that you still had this itch for doing something that's more entrepreneurial and taking that sort of background?
Totally. So what I always, growing up in Southern California, you remember the concept of the e-ticket at Disneyland, mm-hmm. right? So what I kind of saw the path to doing what I wanted to do, so to speak, was like you had to kind of punch the ticket a couple of times to get the e-ticket. And in venture, what I learned about was seeding companies, getting ABC rounds, and either getting them public through a liquidity event in an M&A or an IPO, and how that works, or killing them, right? So I learned that early stage to scale. At the bank, what we were doing is we were basically lending money to companies on cash flow to go buy other things, or lending money to private equity funds to go buy stuff. And because there was an equity component and usually two layers of debt, we were able to basically provide most of the senior secured, which was kind of a commodity type of piece, in order to get strips of the other piece to invest in. So there, what I learned how to do is to probably take a $20 million minimum EBITDA platform, so $20 million, $100 million revenue company, and turn it into a $1 billion asset or a $2 billion asset, right? Figure out how to put as little equity into that deal as I can, use the most leverage, scale it, sell it, understand how the waterfall goes to every single layer of that capital structure, understand how they work, and understand the process. So from a pure, like when I say I'm just a dumb corporate finance guy, like there's two fundamental playbooks in terms of how you make money in venture capital and in private equity. And I was like on the front lines of doing both of it. So when I got into that position in the bank, which I almost washed out of because it was so difficult, and we could talk about that, I kind of said, this is something I'm going to do for a while, but it's not something that I'm going to do for the rest of my life. And I don't know what that thing is, but I can't, I'm going to murder someone if I stay inside the institution for too long.
I get that completely, for sure. You moved into life sciences, right, as sort of your industry kind of specialty. Why life sciences? Did that have anything to do with sort of your dad's background as well?
It totally had to do with my dad. So my dad was doing it on his own. So 96, 97, 98, 99, I started really moving into the bank. I started, you know, working on billion-dollar plus financings and M&A. And I'd call my dad and I'd be like, God, I just did a $600 million deal. And he'd like hang up on me. Great. Okay. Like, who cares? And for me, making money isn't about power. You might not believe this. It's not about things. It's just about freedom, right? It's about being able to do what I want to do. And the path that was laid out for me for the bank was, you're here 10 years, do this another 10 years, and we're going to really make it worth your while. And I was like, I'm going to kill myself if I do this. So I was looking for a way out because I was like the 11th guy on a deal team that had put us into a deal that cash on cash was an 1100% IRR in 13 months. And they came into my office and did a big ceremony and gave me a check. And my expectation was, call it six digits, the very low end of six digits. You know, we put $1 million to work, we made $11 million. Okay. And let's just say the check was like maybe on the low end of four digits. And I was just like, I'm just never going to, you know, my dad would always say, you're never going to make any money working there. And once that happened, the light went on and the bank was such a great place to work. It was a gold mine of inefficiency if you are an entrepreneur. And I think I had like 10 weeks of accrued paid vacation. And I was like, I'm taking a month off. And I traveled with my dad around the world. And it was to see if I could do it with him, to do a business with him, because we didn't get to this, but like from the time I was like 18 to the time I was 32, I couldn't stand to be in the same room as my dad. My dad had done so many things that had so many people who followed him and loved him. And I just wanted to do it on my own, you know, and my dad wanted to like do it for me. And I was like, I don't want you to do it for me. I want you to do it on my own. You know, and it was like that kind of, and after going to the bank, I'd be like, okay, I can do this on my own. Like, it's not that big of a deal. And I went on this trip, and it was after that trip that I said, I'm going to leave the bank and I'm going to go do this with my dad. And although he is my ex-wife, the only person in my stack who was kind of like, yeah, go do this was her. She was like, you have nothing to lose. And everyone else was like, you're going to kill each other. And it worked. So, but it was totally him. It was totally the presence that he had and his, honestly, Len, and I don't want to be given a hyperbole here, his global reach. Like, I literally went on a 30-day world tour with him. We went to Australia, Singapore, London, Switzerland, New York, Tel Aviv. Like, we went around the world for a month, and it was like, you know, the fanfare when he would show up. It was nuts.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up that whole relation with your dad because, you know, similarities again. My dad kicked me out of the house, like physically, literally kicked me out of the house. I had a tremendous amount of anger towards my dad, and we didn't have a really good relationship growing up when I was a kid. I talk to my dad every single day now, And it totally changed. And I think a lot of it had to do with me and what I was sort of holding on to. And when I was able to let all that go and just send love his way, nobody's perfect. We all make mistakes. We have kids, you know, and we're not perfect with them also. But I think giving that up, and then looking at, my dad was an engineer basically all his life, and he was in a company that made semiconductors and all that stuff. Very corporate, never understood entrepreneurship. Whatever I was doing was like foreign to him. But he did have respect, as you, on a different scale than your dad. But he did have that respect, and I always understood that there's a work ethic to this, and given. Making sure that I give up that emotional connection to all the anger that I had, it really, really helped me a lot in my life too. And it must be difficult with having such a high profile, dad and having a path. It's like actors who are, there's a kid of this famous actor now, they're being an actor or they're being a musician. You're always compared. So how did you manage that, especially working together in an industry that he is so well known for?
You nailed it. Like, it worked. I used to joke because I said I reached a sufficient level of maturity to allow it to work. Like, that period that I just articulated for you from, 20 to 32, it sucked, right? Like, I was figuring it out. I couldn't get a job. I finally got a job. I felt like I kept banging my head against the wall because I always wanted what I couldn't have. I touched on it, but that group in the bank ate their young. Like, that's the smartest group of people I've ever worked with. And I was one of the first two people that they had ever not hired out of the bank training program, right? So you either figured out how to model like a champ and sit there and do what they wanted to do in the first 6 months, or they threw you out, right? So, I survived that crucible because of some people that really took me under their wing and said, hey, it's okay, you got this, you're one of us. And I think then getting my training wheels to kind of figure out, okay, I can do this. And then I got a bunch, then you get more and then you get more. And what I said to people is I kind of got a little bit of wisdom there because my dad's the same cantankerous, ornery altacocker he always was. He wasn't changing. So I kind of said, all right, I'll be able to look at this as almost like an MD rainmaker. I'm a senior associate VP level banking relationship. I'm just going to let him do his thing.
He's going to go make it rain. I'm going to go get umbrellas. And that seemed to work pretty well. There was a dynamic which also shifted with us. When I went into the partnership with my dad, because it was massive consolidation occurred on the supply side of the research products industry from 2000 to 2010. Several platforms rolled up into what's now Millipore or all these other companies, Life, whatever they're, PerkinElmer, okay? There were hundreds of small companies, and my dad had relationships with 75 of them. And most of them, if they were good, were family-owned, kind of did one thing really specifically well, and generated between 10 to 20 million in revenue at an 80% gross margin. So we walked into two of those to sell them as the broker. That's how we started the business. And within 16 months, I had sold two companies. I sold one division of a pubco for $5 million. And I sold another private company for 4x revenue. Wow. And about a month after that second wire hit, there was a precipitous change in my father's demeanor where he stopped treating me like a child and he started treating me like an equal. And that's really what allowed it to work. But nothing about him ever changed.
Yeah, you were able to earn his respect. Maybe that's a way of him trying to groom you in a certain way to get there. So, so you have that kind of relationship. Yeah. Now, you know, that's, you reminded me of my relationship. You know, there's nothing about my dad that changed. Yeah. He's calmed down a lot in his old age, but he's not changing. It's me that has to make the change to be able to maintain that relationship, which was my choice. And I think a lot of people don't understand that. They really think that they can get somebody to change. You're never going to get anybody to change. It's you. So trajectory-wise, cannabis. Why cannabis, and how did that move from, you know, life sciences and what you were doing into this amazing industry that we're taking part in? The green
bush. Honestly, serendipity, man. You know, because of the type of guy that my dad was, I didn't party in high school. I don't think I drank a beer until the summer of my senior year. I went to school in Denver, man. And the kind of stuff that I saw my first week there, I was like, what is going on? So by the time I was a sophomore, I was smoking cannabis daily, and I did till the time I was about 26. So I realized that there was value in the plant. I also always thought there was going to be some level of commercial outcome from it. And what happened to me was that a lot of what my dad and I did in our biotech practice was take a company or an asset or two companies or two assets that were failing, figure out a way to put them together and get them out. And a lot of ways that we got them out was through what you would call a reverse merger. Mm-hmm. And so we did two of those deals. One was a company that we had been involved with for a long time that was on the bulletin board that in 2011 ended up uplisting to NASDAQ. The guys that are inside and running AGP were actually the guys who did that financing. And that company just like hit a stride that worked. It happens in life sciences where things will just get hot. And they were one of the first active immunotherapy, which is now kind of called cell therapy companies. And it went from a 9-cent bulletin board stock to a $600 million NASDAQ company. It's come back down. But that ride occurred as a result of us like changing a tire on the company, right? And I did another one like that where I took a private co in the US and reverse merged it into a pub co in Australia. And that kind of doubled as well. So if you hadn't invested with me on the first one, I was like, yo, like I called you on this company and here's what happened. Don't miss the second ride. Sorry about this. I have this thing where this happens now. Wait, hold on. Yeah.
I love it.
I'm turning it off. Another one. Hold on. Let's see if I can get this to go. There we go. Hey. I don't know how to turn it off. So what happened, my dad had great relationships. And one of the great relationships that we had was a group that does public and investor relations, kind of like KSCA in cannabis. They were called the Trout Group, and they were probably one of the premier global groups. And the guy who founded it was one of my closer friends in the industry. And they got turned on to GW as the IR firm when GW did their ADR in like 2004. So I was on that story for a long time. I got a call one day at the end of 2011, and the call basically said, hey, cannabis is going to go recreational in Canada, and we want to clone a company like GW for the express purpose of doing a pump and dump. And I went on that ride with those guys. I raised that company $43 million, kind of did a round trip on it, got involved in two more. And from kind of 2012 to 2017, you know, there's a cohort of about 30 listed cannabis companies that had an aggregate market cap of about $6 billion. And I was about $1 billion of that market cap in terms of the stuff that I had done. Mm-hmm. So
what I thought I was going to do, honestly, was I thought I was going to take a $10 pre-roll and turn it into a $70 pharmaceutical product. That proved to be almost impossible. Because of college, I knew a guy in New York named Jason Pinsky, who is, you probably know,
my neighbor. Oh. Now he moved up the street. I just ran into him.
So make sure you get some sour D. And
he had a baby, by the way. I'm sure you know.
I know. And I had maintained a relationship with him because I met him in New York. And as cannabis started coming up, we had a lot of really interesting run-ins. And he came out and started working for Ease. And I didn't realize it, but I was like circumnavigating Ease. And I met a guy named Nick Fasano through him. And somehow, and it's a great story, but somehow I convinced Ease that they should hire me to raise money because they were kind of down to what I would call beyond fumes. And, you know, from 2Q of 19 to Q1 of 22, I helped Ease to raise $130 million. And I can say without any hesitation that myself and Corey Azzolino and maybe two other people facilitated the Green Dragon merger inside of that company. And I went from not really understanding cannabis to being an influencer, allegedly. And the power of Ease as a platform and as an acquirer was just so great. I was instantly relevant. And it wasn't methodical and it wasn't planned. It just kind of happened. And what I see is maybe the biggest capital market opportunity ever. So I've just leaned into it.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, because of your previous experience, life sciences and banking and all that stuff, how cannabis is different. And I mean, I just want the audience to really understand that from your perspective than any of those other industries. And also this whole valuation thing, it's so odd in the cannabis industry because of all its different challenges, even IP wise, like, you know, in life sciences, it's very clear. There's a drug or you have a product, you go through FDA approval, you have some sort of valuation around that. But in cannabis, it doesn't work because of, you know, you have state laws, you have federal laws, you have all these other obstacles and encumbrances. So how is it different? And then how are the valuations different than, you know, traditional, quote unquote, businesses?
So I'm going to answer that with two questions. How's it different? And like, how are the valuations different? Okay. Mm-hmm. I just got back from the JP Morgan conference. It was literally like the Walking Dead. We don't have any money. There's no investors. The investors aren't going to put any money into our company. Cannabis is an exception. Sorry. Life sciences is an exceptionally capital constrained industry. I want to say, and I could be wrong, but I want to say in terms of all the money that's out there, there's about $6 billion of investment capital, and I could be low, and I want to check the number, that's dedicated just to invest in life sciences. Mm-hmm. So it's trillion. And it's really hard to find money. I did a post on that. That's 27 times the amount of money that's available to cannabis. So if you have an industry that's globally legal, that has well-established distribution channels, that's selling hundreds of millions of dollars of product, that allegedly in some cases saves people's lives, and it's still really hard to raise money for novel companies there. Imagine how much harder it is for something that's federally illegal and has 27 times less money. Start there. That's the main difference.
if you then drill that down as kind of like 1A into the models, you have a problem. And the problem is that anybody who has raised money to invest in the sector hasn't made any money. So if you're already 27 times as constrained, and let's say you have $3 billion of capital or $4 billion that's been deployed to cannabis, and a billion of it has been spent in equity and none of it's been returned, you're not getting that refreshed. So the reason that cannabis is different is that your N of investors is much smaller, A, and B, the amount of capital that they have is much more limited. If I then go to your question two, how are valuations? Valuations are done like this. So you don't really have a realistic barometer via which to value private companies other than typically as a multiple of revenue or where they priced their last round. So you can get a gauge. And because every public company is essentially a micro cap, they're not going to be able to get rewarded for performance like a company is on NASDAQ, because you just don't have the institutional investor base that's going to invest in these stocks. So that's the way that it's fun. It's fundamentally constrained. You know, it's playing the drums with an arm, with your right arm tied behind your back and your left and your right feet tied together.
Yeah, it's a great, such a good analogy. And I'm glad you because, you know, I'm a CEO in the space. So I deal with this all the time. Do you, as somebody who's in the business or getting into the cannabis space or is in the cannabis, should you have an exit in mind when you're going out and raising capital? Is that really important for you to know, like, there is an exit so your shareholders can have something of a light at the end of the tunnel?
I look at it differently, especially in cannabis, because if someone comes to me and says, I'm going to exit, am I allowed to use foul language on your podcast?
Use whatever you want, man.
They're full of shit because there just aren't any exits. There's not a cash on cash exit. So what I tend to focus more on is, can you make money? Can you show me that you're going to make money? Because if you can make money, it doesn't really matter about the exit. I can give my investors a return. It might not be the return they want. But if the exits start coming with cash, which is what you want, you know, or paper and something that's more interesting, which I think is less interesting, given the entire sector's down 80%, if you have a business that makes money, that's where I tend to tell people to focus these days, as opposed to the exit.
But isn't making money right now sort of short-term versus what's going to happen with long-term, especially if their companies are investing in IP and technology and positioning themselves for what the future of the industry is? You know, the FDA made the recommendation to reschedule to a schedule three or possibly even a four. Yes, the DEA blocked this, but it's given us a little bit of an insight on sort of what the government's looking at, and some other place in the world are, you know, doing the same kind of thing. And if you're cultivating right now, and you're selling pre-rolls and you're making money, maybe that business isn't going to last that much longer once the regulations change.
You could be 100% right. I don't have the capability to prognosticate the future. And moreover, I don't have the capability to understand what law is going to require people to do. I kind of look at it at the dry cleaner mentality. What do I mean by that? I live in Hermosa Beach. There's 17 dry cleaners here. They all seem to do okay. There's one guy that owns three stores. The rest of them are making money somehow. And if you have a dry cleaner and it's making money, I mean, unless Simonizing comes in and takes over the town, I think there's some inherent value in that. So I also think, depending upon the model, you know, you might be more at risk. Look, if I look at the models, and there's probably 12 in cannabis, like, I think if you have cultivation and cultivation is functioning and you grow good product and you're profitable, and that's hard,
I inherently think you should be able to do that for a while, unless ubiquitously cheap, you know, product comes in via interstate commerce, or unless the black market just becomes more and more and more of a force. So I think to your point of, isn't that short-sighted? It is, but we're also kind of making up the, we're building the plane as we fly it. So I could also as easily come back to you and say, well, you're going to tell me you're going to exit your company to who and when? Because anybody who's exited, unless you're one of a very elite unicorn cohort, you didn't get any cash. So what, you want paper and MedMen? Great. Take as much paper in MedMen as you want. It's got a bathroom full of it. I got a whole room of my house that's wallpapered in MedMen chairs. You can come visit me.
That's great. You mentioned on your LinkedIn, by the way, I want to talk about your LinkedIn and sort of your rebranding of yourself as this LinkedIn guru, which I love listening to your stuff. I think it's great, entertaining. But you mentioned some companies and brands are doing this, doing it right. So this is a two-part question. Why are they doing it right? And you don't have to mention who they are. You can. It's fine. You can mention the brands. Why are they doing it right? And what mistakes have been made that you have maybe been a part of also that sort of you learn from and, you know, can actually communicate and you know, maybe coach people not to make those same mistakes that you did as part of your whole LinkedIn platform.
You want me to talk about the mistakes on LinkedIn or the mistakes?
No. In the companies, not on LinkedIn. No, your LinkedIn mistakes are great.
Thanks. Let's start with the companies. I talk a lot about them on LinkedIn. I think there's probably two pretty, there's one very common theme in the companies that I talk about that don't work, which is poor stewardship of capital. So if we look at a couple of the notable failures in cannabis, and I would call what happened at MedMen a failure, because the principal owners of MedMen are friends of mine. I won't call MedMen a failure, but the up and down of MedMen is a failure. I think the theme there is just poor capital stewardship. You were making poor decisions. You were overbuilding systems and overbuilding infrastructure and overpaying for things and spending a bunch of money on advertising in the expectation of future demand, without a lot of adult supervision, without a lot of capital discipline. I think that's a theme that I've seen repeatedly in companies. Took a lot of money and we just basically didn't spend it wisely. People could argue that that was spent intelligently, but you know, there's probably two or three companies that I could think of in California where I could make the same analogy. So to your second point, I really think it's just prudence. Just prudence. Spending money to grow demand as opposed to, you know, liquidating money in the expectation of future growth.
That makes sense.
I think the companies that are working, I think a lot of them are working out of happenstance, or a lot of them are working because they follow, you know, kind of three or four basic models, which is they tend to be private. They tend to be between 10 and 70 million in revenue. They tend to have taken little outside capital. If they have, it's not punitive. The founders have focused on figuring out ways to be profitable. Usually that's with a grow and a brand. Sometimes that's with an inverse asset light model. Sometimes that's with a licensing model. On a more limited basis, it's with a retail structure. I've also seen it with a grow and retail on a limited basis. I've also seen it on a pure cultivation structure. people that are just in vape, people that are just in extraction at vape. I think that's challenging. So I think five or six models that I've seen emerge seem to work. The ones which seem to be most sustainable or most pervasive is someone who's taking a small cost factor input like distillate and putting it into an edible or similar kind of product that they're building brand affinity around.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So I also think that there's another theme in most of the companies that I articulate as working, which is that there's one or two people in there that are friggin' maniacal about what they're doing, right? It's all they are doing all the time, and they're obsessive about it, and they're obsessive about everything down to the way the box fits in the carton. So
I mean, you kind of read my mind, because I was going to ask you what the best way to raise capital today is in our space and in the cannabis space. But, you know, the second part of the question you were just alluding to, the C-suite or the CEO or the founder, whoever that is, how important is that individual or those kind of individuals in making it an investment decision? And does that help even in today's market in terms of raising capital?
It's everything, man, because that's ultimately what they're investing in, the person.
Yeah.
So if we look at a bunch of brands that I've talked about, like just talk about, you know, two or three where you have a Golden State and Pure Beauty and Garden Society, it just is three. At AGS, you have two guys that are maniacally obsessed with what they're doing, one on the FP&A side and one on the quality and the branding side. At Garden Society, you have probably one of the best CBOs I've ever met in my entire life, in Aaron Gore, who, you know, used to run a global division for a German chemical company and won the Nike account. So the level of obsession that she has in terms of her SOPs and her protocol is beyond, you know, most CGMP manufacturers. As a matter of fact, she is a CGMP manufacturer in Ohio. If I look at Pure Beauty, Imelda and her partner Tracy have done an amazing job to build a brand with awareness and then have put the pieces around it to be able to turn it into a really good company. But, you know, I think her background was like as a civil rights lawyer or an ACLU lawyer. Right. So all three of those companies treat the money like it's their own, and they've all invested their own money in the companies. Right. So they're making decisions that say, okay, what's the best thing for me? Like it's my own money. And I think those help. Yeah. And, you know, to your point, it's all about the person. I talk a lot about a company called Can. Full disclosure, my friend Nick Fasano is the chief revenue officer in there. But I really think, and I don't want to give any level of discredit to Jake, because he's turned that thing into a monster. But that company is that company because Luke Anderson could raise $20 million for what I have left in this glass bottle. Like that. I've never seen it. I've seen maybe four people in my life raise money as proficiently as Luke Anderson has for that company. And they are investing in him and his vision.
Yeah.
And I will say something else.
Yeah.
Luke, I love you. You're a fucking disaster other than that, right? Like, do not ever invite me to another Christmas party, because that was a red flag for me. I love it. But, you know, I mean, he's raised money like nobody I've ever seen, based upon the force of his vision and personality.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that, because in this industry, as we just said, we don't know. You don't have a crystal ball. We don't know what's going to happen. And people that are investing in this industry, especially because they got burnt already, the people are so important, because your investors want to understand that you're going to treat their money like it's your money, and that you're actually you're in this business. This is what you do all day, every day, you know, 24 hours a day when you're sleeping. And I think that's a huge, huge reason why people invest, that whole personality connection too. They invest in you, and you have to connect to the individuals. I want to kind of shift gears a little bit, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but we may have daughters similar age. Is your daughter starting college or started college this year?
Yep, she did.
Yeah, so same with mine. Exactly the same thing. Mine went to Berkeley this year. So I wanted to ask you, on a personal level, not knowing your connection with your daughter, but I'm just kind of projecting myself, this whole, you know, getting your daughter to college and being away and all that stuff, how'd you deal with that? Well, how did it impact you?
Well, first of all, I'm very lucky because I love my daughter a lot and I have an amazing relationship with her, and I'm grateful she's in my life. It was hard, man. My daughter does not have a great relationship with her mom. And that's really challenging. And, you know, the process of, she was a very focused academic, and the process of getting her into college was brutal. She applied to 26 colleges. It's been nice to get her out and launched and off to the races. And I think she's doing well and adjusting well there. But her senior year of college was probably my most difficult year as a parent.
Yeah. High school. Yeah. I get it.
Senior year of high school. Yeah. Her senior year of high school was my most.
Yeah. Year. Yeah. I got it. Yeah. I kind of concur with that. And I had the same kind of feeling on, yes, I'm launching you to your new future, but man, I feel an emptiness, you know, walk in a room. And I'm like, oh, she's not there kind of thing. So, but it was great to spend some time during the holidays with her here and see the maturity.
You know, I mean, I think you gotta, as part of life, let that happen. I've kind of come to the conclusion they're never really off your P&L. And at this day and age, they're coming home and living with you anyway. So, you know, after that senior year of high school, I was kind of like, you need to go now. Like, have fun. Goodbye.
Yep.
Get out.
Nah, I get it. Okay. So I have a few questions I ask all my guests. So first, please describe your first experience with cannabis.
My first experience with cannabis was my sophomore year of college. And I remember it just being absolutely amazing. I was around a exceptionally drug-filled environment in Denver, and me taking the step into smoking cannabis was a big deal. And I remember having an extremely enjoyable experience and wanting more and more, to the point where by probably the end of my junior year, I was smoking weed 3 times a day or more.
So being a music person like yourself, do you remember the very first concert that you attended?
I don't remember the first concert that I attended, but I do remember the first time that I took mushrooms was at a Blues Travelers concert on their first album. They played at a really small venue in Denver. I can't remember the name of it, but I went there with these four girls that were intermittently on tour with the Dead. And I remember eating mushrooms for probably the first or second time. And I told these girls, if Popper plays Dropping Some NYC, I'm taking my clothes off. So I proceeded to stay through the second set in my underwear. It was fucking good. It was good.
That's a great story. What was the last concert you attended?
Thank you to my partner, mentor, and sometimes investor, Craig Fox, for having me show up at Bob Weir's band at the Greek.
And I got to see the entire Dead and Company set that night. So it was Bob Weir and the Wolf Brothers. That's what they're called. The Greek. Mm-hmm.
Super cool. Okay. So a little bit of a challenging question. You may have to think through this a little bit. If you had to listen to five albums for the next year, and I'm going to preface saying that you don't have to remember the name of the album. Like you can just say, you know, Grateful Dead album or whatever that is. What would be the five albums that you would listen to for the next year?
Probably Grateful Dead, Working Man's Dead, Jimi Hendrix, Smash Hits. Probably Miles Davis, Relaxing with Miles. Maybe Ice Cube's first album. America Cosmos Wanted.
Yes.
And then what would be my last? Maybe Zeppelin 2.
Probably where I'm going.
Yep. Cool. What has cannabis meant in your life?
That I'm finally at the level that I should be at. My dad died in 2014. My mom died in 2016. In 2017, I closed 9 transactions. So I think one of the things that we didn't touch on in the past was this notion of self-awareness. Mm-hmm. From the time I was 40, I got divorced. I lost 2 dogs. I lost my dad. I lost my mom. I was either going to become a giant asshole or the most self-aware guy ever, and I did. And I think I'm at this moment in cannabis where the intersection of my authenticity and my skill set and the place where the industry is at is putting me above where my dad was and putting me in a position that I've been working for 35 or 40 years. So it's given me that place. And I'm not done, but, you know, I'm a wild card in the playoffs. And some people think I'm Mahomes, and I'm really just making it up as I go along. So
is Mahomes. being an Eagles fan.
Ugh. As a Philly guy, look, he beat you on one leg, bro. He beat you on – a guy was on one leg in that game.
I mean, who knows about that? Or maybe he played possum really well and walked off, and they're like, they think I have one leg, and who knows? Sorry.
Such a Philly fan. Guy was on one leg, Lenny.
I don't know about that, but all right. So final bonus question. And before I get to that, you brought up something and I usually have my flow, but this whole notion of being self-aware and what you're doing on LinkedIn, I didn't ask you, but I kind of alluded to that. It's sort of a rebranding of yourself. And I really feel a genuine connection to what you're sharing with people. Yes, obviously there's a reason why, but there's a part of me that feels it's like giving back. And I'm not sure if people really understand that you're actually like whatever. And I don't know what your mindset is around this, but it feels to me like, yes, you're putting something out there. You're putting content out there to help people that someone will come back to you. But I don't know if that's your intention. It really feels genuine from me that you're giving something to people and they really should dive deeper into your content because it's really good.
Thank you. You know, it all started because the transaction business goes like this. And I wanted to find a way to monetize what I thought was an asset, and I didn't know how to do it. It seems like that's begun to manifest on that journey, because I think I am pretty self-aware and authentic. It seems like outside of cannabis, more broadly on LinkedIn, there's a broad creator community that's very symbiotic. And to the extent that you're willing to extend them knowledge or time or credence, it comes back to you in spades. So part of my self-awareness, and I've spoken about it on LinkedIn, it's part of my sales strategy in just life, is that I'm just kind of giving this away without really any expectation of anything in return. It's like I'm sitting in a Porsche dealership and I'm just waiting for you to come and buy a 911. Like, I'm going to be here all day. If you want to buy the car, great. If not, the car's not going to be here tomorrow, but I will be. Right? It's like that kind of a shtick. And it seems to work, you know. So I went into it, you know, with the mindset of this is how I'm going to go after it. It's taken a complete life of its own. It's a lot of work. I really, really, really enjoy it.
So that's probably the most important thing. I enjoy it as much as almost doing anything else at this
Yeah,
point.
it definitely comes through that way, and it's something of a motivator for me because that's an area that I want to start focusing a lot more and giving back. I work with so many young entrepreneurs, and they're trying to get into space, or I really feel like there's a way that I can do that in a more global fashion.
Ben, and look, stay tuned. Like, you know, I'm planning to make I think what happened on LinkedIn for me in 2023 was I was just authentic and consistent, and I tried a little bit, right? Like a little bit. This year, especially after my ban and after being pulled down, I'm pissed. I got goals, and I'm trying really hard. So I think even in the next 2 weeks, you'll see kind of a fundamental shift in where I'm going, honestly, to position myself as a broad creator on the platform and on other platforms because of this reason. A lot of the people that are on there are young and gifted and talented and really smart, but there's not many people who have done the number of transactions that I've done, seen the number of deals that I've done, and closed what I've closed. And that's real value. And what I intend to do is leverage that to become hopefully as big as some of these other people. That's where I want to go with it. You know, it's been really empowering. And, you know, I've just met so many amazing, amazing people there. And it's fun. I'm having more fun there than I've ever had.
Love it.
And
All right.
one final thing. I will tell you that 90% of my business conversations right now start with, I love what you're doing on LinkedIn.
It's cool, man. I love it as well. All right. So, final bonus question. Please describe what your room looked like growing up.
What age? What age do you want me to describe that?
You choose whatever you think is the most memorable room that you can describe.
Mid-80s, I think I had a bunch of, you know, of my football team pictures up on one wall, and then I had, you know, those classic cheesy, you know, Lamborghini Countach wine bottle silhouette of a naked woman, like six of those posters on the wall. And I did have the classic Farrah Fawcett Majors poster on the wall. So that was about it. I also liked to build model airplanes when I was a kid, so I had those hanging from the ceiling.
So it's so funny because I had very similar posters. I did model cars, not airplanes. So I had a bunch of my model cars out there. But and I did have, I think, speaking of 84, I guess I had a Van Halen 1984 poster with David Roth jumping in the air. That was my and Bruce Lee posters too. So very similar.
Gotcha.
Seth, I want to thank you so much for your time. Where can people engage, connect with you, you know, find out more?
Just
So.
go to my LinkedIn. I'm launching this year. I have a website for my firm, which is called Cait & Associates. It's on there. I am, because of my LinkedIn ban, creating my own personal branded website, which is just me. So that'll be dropping here probably in the next 30 to 45 days. But just go to my LinkedIn and please follow me.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
Season 1 of Dope History is now available at dopehistory.com. Dope History weaves you through the lives of those who have been touched by cannabis or have had an influence on the events that shaped our laws or relationships with this plant. You'll hear tales from Frenchie Cannoli, Keith Strop, Eddie Lepp, Tom Alexander, Ed Rosenthal, Wolf Seagall, Jorge Cervantes, and Tommy Chong. Available now at dopehistory.com.